Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Steve Cole, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He was president of the New America Foundation and worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize, and is currently a staff writer for The New Yorker, the author of seven other books, including The Bin Ladens and Private Empire. His latest book just out is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Cole.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be here.
And the book covers the whole war. This is America's longest war, 17 years and going. So let's start with some of the extraordinary revelations in your book, starting with the first bombs that dropped after 9/11 on Afghanistan. You say that Mullah Omar and his coterie of top leadership could have been wiped out?
Yeah, the CIA had been watching his house in Kandahar before the air war began on October 7th, 2001. It was a well-known location, and he was there. And they had a drone with Hellfire missiles above Mullah Omar's house. And the book describes this kind of misadventure that night where they were planning to strike him, but they could never quite get a decision made. The command was fractured. The CIA wasn't really in charge. The military wasn't sure that they could hit him when they had him because of rules of that come from the Bush administration about not striking religious facilities. And eventually he got away. And, you know, a couple of months later, Osama bin Laden got away at Tora Bora. And so a consequence of an otherwise, you know, lightning strike successful war in 2001 in knocking over the Taliban's government, you know, scattering al-Qaeda, was that two very important leaders escaped to Pakistan and the war kind of gradually shifted in that direction.
So Directorate S, of course, is this secret unit within the ISI, the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency of the Pakistan military. And, of course, the longstanding joke is that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. Mm. And my sense in the broadest sense is that Pakistan plays a pretty insidious game with the U.S. Basically, they're saying, you know, we're a nuclear power, the fastest growing nuclear power in the world, but we also have a problem with an insurrection and jihadis. So you, the United States, have got to give us money to stabilize our country because we don't want our nuclear weapons falling in the hands of the very jihadis who the state sponsors, nurtures, trains, and sets loose on all kinds of people, including the United States. A friend of mine at Georgetown, Chris Fares, describes this as a self-licking ice cream. How would you describe it?
I think you've described it well. I mean, in a way, Pakistan has used its nuclear deterrent to enlarge the sphere in which it can make mischief. And this is a kind of an interesting aspect of nuclear deterrence. It used to be that deterrence theory was about making sure another nuclear power didn't attack you for fear of escalation. But with these weaker states in rough neighborhoods like Pakistan's, nuclear deterrence has convinced the army and ISI that they can get away with nurturing militias and pursuing proxy wars and dirty wars across their borders in a way they almost certainly could not get away with if they didn't have nuclear weapons. And then the nuclear weapons are not a threat. It's not a threat that they're going to use them against the United States. It's the threat that they'll fall into the wrong hands, that the state is so weak that you have to be careful not to destabilize it. And it is insidious because the state is responsible for the very weakness that it uses in this way by mostly since the 1980s, with CIA collaboration during the 1980s, learning that these Islamist guerrillas and proxy forces could, in fact, unsettle India. In a kind of asymmetric contest in which Pakistan is the weaker state, right? Smaller in population, smaller industrial base, and they've used these guerrillas as a way to keep India off balance.
So your book, Directorate S, also tells the diplomatic story along with the military story, both of which, of course, are, again, we are in a situation today where we can't say that we're going to win or we're making any progress, but all we can say is that if we don't stay, it'll get a lot worse. So It's not exactly a great deal for the American taxpayer in America's longest war, and I don't know what the bill so far is. But I recall that Richard Holbrooke, when he first got that portfolio as a special envoy, thought about going to the source, if you will, to solve Kashmir, and therefore that would be the beginning of kind of, if you solve the external threat, or at least the perception of threat that the Pakistanis have about India, then maybe they're not going to be destabilizing Afghanistan because of their fear of Indian mischief causing them to fight a two-front war. But I understand that it was the Indian lobby, not in Washington, that stymied that. Would that have worked, do you think?
Well, the timing was a little bit off, but I mean, the theory is understandable. There was a time in around 2006 when India and Pakistan in a different era did come close to settling quite a lot of their grievances around Kashmir, territorial grievances in the Siachen Glacier and Sir Creek, and a framework for a kind of political future for Kashmir that would be nonviolent. And it fell apart because President Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan, his government collapsed because of his own domestic political failures. And so by the time Holbrooke came in, you know, Pakistan was in the throes of the worst domestic terrorism that it's ever known. I mean, there were car bombings in major cities. The Pakistani Taliban had been born. They had assassinated Benazir Bhutto. There just wasn't stable enough ground in Pakistan to negotiate a big detente with India. I mean, Holbrooke did poke around at it. He tried to persuade the Indians to be part of the solution. But in the end, the bolder effort that he conceived and that after he died in December 2010, others carried on, was to negotiate directly with the Taliban to see if they could develop some kind of path to reduce the violence in the war and maybe even negotiate Taliban participation in Afghan politics. And so the book tells this, you know, this really, I had covered some of it, but I tried to get really underneath the surface of the negotiation. The Taliban appointed a representative of their political commission to negotiate with the Americans. And they negotiated with him for almost 2.5 years on and off, a number of meetings, exchanged quite a lot of information and ideas about how to go forward. The Taliban's position was, we don't want to be an ISI client. Yes, we are vulnerable to Pakistan. Our families live in Pakistan. We need Pakistani passports and identity cards. You know, that's where our homes are. But we see ourselves as Afghans, and we don't want them negotiating for us. We want you to negotiate with you directly. Americans said, well, okay, we recognize that. Let's talk. But ultimately, any settlement is going to have to bring ISI in. And so they were in this very complicated position. ISI was furious that the Americans were talking to their clients, the Taliban, without their involvement, and they tried to sabotage the effort from time to time. And the whole thing blew up. Part of the reason was what I just described. Part was the estrangement between President Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan and the Obama administration. Karzai also didn't trust this negotiation. But, you know, the United States did learn something from the attempt. And these long, long wars that are stalemated like this one is, apart from just packing up and going home and letting the chaos run its course, the only other alternative ever is negotiating some kind of reduction of violence.
And again, Steve Cole has joined me in the studio. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He was president of the New America Foundation and worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize, and is currently a staff writer for The New Yorker, the author of 7 other books, including The Bin Ladens and Private Empire. His latest book just out is Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And of course, the U.S., I think, pretty clearly bungled the election and during the Obama administration, as much as I know I've spoken to Peter Galbraith about it, was working for the UN at the time. He had the temerity of saying there was some fraud.
Yes.
Instead of dealing with the fraud, they fired him.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, obviously this Karzai was a restaurateur, wasn't he, or something?
His brothers were.
Brothers were. I mean, it didn't seem like a great choice to begin with. But then once he realized the U.S. didn't wanted him out, or weren't, you know, too happy with him, he became more and more sour on them. This current guy doesn't seem to be doing much better neither, does he?
No, he was also the product of a fraud-riddled election, right, that was a crisis of the same type as the 2009 one, and the solution was kind of patched together through Band-Aid diplomacy, but it hasn't really taken. Right. And he's estranged from Abdullah, his own prime minister. The mistake with Karzai was avoidable. I think, you know, Richard Holbrooke came in and started trying to find an alternative to Karzai, and Karzai immediately saw that the Americans wanted him replaced, but there was no plan to actually replace him. So you ended up with the worst of both worlds. He was reelected for 5 years, and he was furious that the Americans no longer saw him as an ally or a reliable partner. There's this scene in the book where Karzai goes walking in the garden of his palace with one of his ministers, and the minister says, "You know, Mr. President, the Americans have been unfair to you. They originally called you an Afghan Mandela. Now they call you an Afghan Mugabe. But, you know, we have to also take responsibility for some of our own mistakes." But Karzai increasingly was so estranged that he would say wild things in private to his colleagues. You know, the Americans can just leave. I'll call the Taliban back. We'll make an alliance with the Taliban. And this minister said to him, "You know, Mr. President, if the Taliban come back, if the Americans go, it's not going to affect the United States that much, but we will be all wiped out." And so that's what kept him on side.
Well, it obviously, though, is a rentier state. Mm. Has been and probably always will be. So it leads you to ask the question that when they had their victory, notwithstanding that they could have got Mularamo and Osama bin Laden, I don't know whether there would have been another way around it by simply not trying to throw good money after bad on trying to build something that has never existed and perhaps would never work. But you'll never get anywhere, obviously, and this is what the book makes clear, particularly with the secret part of the ISI Directorate S, as long as the Pakistanis are thwarting you at every turn, which is what they've done. So at the end of the day, what is their end game? Because you'd think they'd be concerned about reverse sanctuary from destabilized Afghanistan pouring back into their country, which is hardly that stable to begin with. What are they thinking here?
Well, during the period described in the book, particularly, say, the period from 2007 up toward the president, but their main priority was to restore domestic security because they'd lost control of the militant groups that they had suckered for so long, and they had turned against the Pakistani state, and tens of thousands of Pakistanis died in this terrorism campaign, security services, security forces, and militants and civilians. And so their main objective for a good while, I think, was to push the trouble out of Pakistan back into Afghanistan, in their view, from where it had come after the U.S. invaded and al-Qaeda fled into Pakistan, lashed up with these local groups and set off this campaign against the Pakistani state. So I think first it was about stability. Now, the Americans would come to them as Pakistan slowly started to get control back over its own territory, and they would ask the question you ask, well, what do you really want? What's your end game? And for a while, Ashraf Ghani, who was the former head of ISI, now the most powerful man in Pakistan during the years of this book, the head of the army, he would say, we want a friendly government in Afghanistan. Okay, so the Americans heard that, the Afghans heard that, and they thought, oh, you want to control us again. You want the Taliban back in power. And they would challenge Ghani. So you're telling us you need to own politics in Afghanistan? That's not acceptable to the Afghan people. Then Ghani revised his position. He said, well, I'm sorry if you misunderstood my friendly to meaning influenced. I just want stability. And we don't want the Taliban back in power. We don't think that's good for us. But we need more of a balanced arrangement in Afghanistan where the Taliban have participation. And so that all these Afghan Taliban that have taken refuge in my country can go home and participate and not cause trouble here in Pakistan. So that was the basis of, we can talk about that. Even Karzai said, well, let's talk about that. And Karzai was tempted, often, you know, invited by Pakistan into a separate deal with Pakistan. Well, let's forget about the Americans. Let's just cut a deal here in our neighborhood. But it never took. I guess my own reading of the Pakistani leadership is that they tend to have a condescending attitude towards Afghanistan, and they don't actually understand their own neighbor as well as they think they do. They overreach. And they continually pick bad clients, the Taliban, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar of an earlier generation. And they don't understand that Afghans themselves have become very nationalistic. And the one thing Pakistan's interference has really done is to try to is to bring Afghans together, especially young Afghans, in opposition.
Well, of course, we don't have a particularly stellar record.
No, that's right.
But, you know, given that that Afghanistan is landlocked and the lanes in there, the SLOCs or whatever they call them, are completely controlled by Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And occasionally they've jerked our chain by having these trains of trucks interrupted. My understanding is that there was a possibility of working with the Iranians, and the Iranians and the Indians have built a road from the Persian Gulf all the way up to Herat. Mm-hmm. And so is that a case of a missed opportunity? Not that it's dealing with the Iranians is easy, but was that something that we could have looked at? Because we had, you know, we did it through the north, through the Russians, and they gouged us mercilessly. And now, of course, the Russians are actually helping and funding and arming the Taliban. So,
well, I mean, the Iranians, remember on 9/11, when we first looked at the Afghan war that we were about to wage, our allies were also allies of the Iranians. When the CIA teams first went into the Panjshir Valley and started to prepare the Northern Alliance for the coming war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, who did they find? They found Indians there running hospitals and supporting the Northern Alliance. They found Russians there selling helicopters and providing some aid to keep the Taliban, you know, a little bit at bay. And they found a lot of Iranians because, you know, there are cultural, linguistic, ethnic ties between those populations of Afghanistan and Iran. And the Iranians were at the Bonn Accords. They were constructive, even with the Bush administration's kind of axis of evil rhetoric. They hung in there and supported the new arrangements in Afghanistan for their own interests, for their own reasons. But, you know, they didn't, in those days, they didn't see the Taliban as something that they wanted to be revived. They had almost gone to war with the Taliban in 2000. There's sectarian and other differences there. But they gradually, of course, we gradually ratcheted up our hostility toward Iran, and the reformist government yielded to, you know, a more ardent nationalistic government in Ahmadinejad's era. And, you know, we were as blinded by our enmity toward Iran as anything else in the region. So that promise of common interests and alternatives to reliance on Pakistan dissolved gradually in the years after the Bonn Accords. But the interests haven't really shifted. You know, I mean, the Iranians see our military presence there as threatening to them, so they would like us out. But ultimately, they have as much of an interest in a stable, sustainable Afghanistan, including one that's influenced by their brethren from the north and the west, as any other neighbor does.
So what is India's role? India does have a role. We know that whether or not it's mendacious or benign, the Pakistanis are completely paranoid about it.
Yep.
So short of making a deal with Iran and having at least an alternative how to supply this landlocked country, what about somehow getting India to, you know, either cooperate with or at least remove the paranoia? Because at the end of the day, I don't see any other situation except we'll go back to perhaps an even worse situation than we had before 9/11.
That's right. Well, I mean, the Pakistanis have, I think, you know, over the years overstated India's presence in Afghanistan, and they have been paranoid about it. But it's a little bit also like the old, you know, joke, just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean India's not out to get you. I mean, they are involved with some of the insurgents inside Pakistan in a tit-for-tat way. I think, you know, India has its own longstanding history in Afghanistan. It has economic interests. It has regional interests. It's not as if Pakistan can wish India out of Afghanistan entirely, although that hasn't stopped them from demanding it from time to time. But the real opportunity is for India to cooperate with the international community, the United States, the region, in supporting a settlement that includes Pakistan and isn't a zero-sum game You know, the Indians have been cautious about their involvement in Afghanistan because they know the Pakistanis are paranoid, and they don't want to provoke Pakistan into launching terrorist strikes inside India in some kind of retaliation for imagined Indian mischief in Afghanistan. And so, they, you know, for example, the Afghans have talked about, well, let's do more military training with the Indians, and let's have more Indian forces join the kind of stabilization effort. And the Indians have been, look, we have enough problems convincing Pakistan not to send terrorist cells into our country or to try to stir up our own Muslim population. Afghanistan isn't worth that price, so we're going to moderate our involvement. They've used soft power more than kind of hard power in Afghanistan. They've let us carry the weight of the counterterrorism campaign.
Well, Steve Cole, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Cole, who's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He was president of the New American Foundation and worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize, and currently is a staff writer for the New Yorker, the author of seven other books, including the Bin Ladens and Private Empire. His latest book just out is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm